This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. We begin with Jerry Seppas. For almost 8 years, he was dean of the Manship School, now recognized as one of the top mass communication entities in higher education. And he arrived in Baton Rouge 10 years ago this month, July of 2011. So he spent a decade in Baton Rouge after a long and distinguished career in other markets, bigger places. And at the San Jose Mercury News, he was executive editor. That newspaper has one of the largest circulations in the United States, and he's known a lot of journalists. He was, as we found out not so long ago, a Washington White House correspondent at one point and has the press badge to prove it. And he has written about the age of Donald Trump, a man solely created by the media as far as his public persona as the Donald, a guy who used to masquerade as other people and call journalists under the pseudonym John Barron and John Miller, and now attacks the media with fervor and has for the last 6 years. 877-217-5757 to engage Jerry Seppas, covering politics in the age of Trump. And before we go to Jerry, here is President Trump, the former president of the United States, who lost the last election by more than 7 million votes. Here he is commenting about his thoughts regarding the media.
Fake news.
Fake news.
You are fake news. We are not going to let the fake news tell us what to do.
Very fake news. You know, you're dishonest people.
The dishonest media.
Your organization is terrible.
The fake media.
All right, keep it going, Matt. Keep it. Matt Doyle, I'm sure you can find something else from the Donald. He's a man of lots of words about the media.
CNN's fake news. I don't take questions. I don't take questions from CNN.
That was just fake news by NBC. Which gives a lot of fake news. It's frankly disgusting the way the press is able to write whatever they want to write.
All right, that's enough. We get the idea. He doesn't like the media, he says. But yet Donald Trump relished attention, and he got lots of it. And a larger-than-life character, as we know, he was easy to write about, talk about. It was easy to do a show when Trump was in office because every day was an adventure. But there was this dark side of him in which he attacked the media and created a new environment which will take a long time to change, if it will ever change, back to the way it was. Jerry Seppas' book is Covering Politics in the Age of Trump. He interviews many reporters, local, national. And first of all, how did you choose the people in the book?
I just looked at people I respect, and to be very honest, a lot of people I know who I thought would be willing to do it because they might be comfortable with me.
And it is a brilliant collection of journalists, and some of whom have, of course, spent time in the studio and telephonically with us. And why don't we start with, you have a section, and I think it's important, about being a person of color in covering Donald Trump. And quite often he would be most hostile to people who didn't look like him. Whether it's a woman or another minority.
Correct. That was the most disappointing part of the whole project. There are three minority journalists who wrote about their experiences with him, and I didn't give them instructions saying write about everything bad that happened. They did it on their own, and when their essays came in, I was shocked that they all had the same ring to them. Mary Curtis, who writes for Roll Call, said that she had never felt as scared as when she was at a Trump rally. People would make jokes about her being off the plantation. And several others said that when Obama was in office, finally black journalists weren't black journalists, they were journalists. And it took a long while to get there. Mm-hmm. But once Trump took office, they were back at the bottom of the barrel.
Well, our producer, Matt Doyle, is also assistant news director at the Louisiana Radio Network. He covered a Trump rally in Lake Charles. And quite often at these rallies, the president would invite physical violence against journalists, calling them names like scum of the earth and menace to society, trying to make bad things happen in our government. It's the same tired litany we hear from people who usually are not president of the United States. That's a Rush Limbaugh-type statement. It's not a presidential-type statement. But yet, these people at times would get physical with journalists. And the journalists, I'd have to say, were in somewhat in a danger zone covering the president of the United States. That says something about the times and the Trump years.
Well, one of the essays is by Ashley Parker, who's now the Washington Post bureau chief at the White House, and earlier worked at the New York Times. And she tells the story of being called out by name at a huge San Diego rally by Trump twice. And the second time he said, who's with the New York Times? I hope it's not Maggie Haberman or Parker because they're not legit. Where's the New York Times reporter? I call it the failing New York Times. And she said the crowd was booing and hissing at that point. She could feel her cheeks turning pink. And she, the best part of it is that she hastily tried to cover up the name sign on her press tent table. But there are repeated stories like that. One writer talks about McKay Coppins of The Atlantic, talks about a smear campaign because Trump didn't like McKay's profile of him. And part of the smear campaign was a 2,000-word story about that visit to Mar-a-Lago from Trump's point of view. And the story was headlined, "Exclusive, Trump. Scumbag, BuzzFeed blogger ogled women while he ate bison at my resort," and it goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I remember he outed Joe Scarborough and Mika and said that he had had them as guests at his resort. And sometimes journalists have conflicts of interest. That's a good question. Should a journalist ever even take up an invitation from somebody like President Trump to visit him at his residence and be treated in grand style? Rush Limbaugh, for example, slept in the Lincoln bedroom and then said nothing but nice things after that about George Bush. That's expected of Rush Limbaugh. But for Joe Scarborough, he's considered by many to be a cut above the Rush man, who's now deceased. But should journalists get too cozy with the people they're covering, Jerry Seppos?
Absolutely not. However, I understand what happened in the case of this McKay Coppins of The Atlantic. He was working on a profile, and Trump said, "Hey, why don't you hop on the plane, come down to Mar-a-Lago with me?" And I don't know what arrangements they made on payment and so forth, but that access would be tough to say no to. But I think you definitely want to pay your way.
Yeah, and sometimes they don't.
Correct.
For years, the Saints used to fly journalists all over the country to cover the games. They were on the team plane. And once Buddy Diliberto said something about the then coach J.D. Roberts, he wasn't on the plane any longer, but that was a perk. And if you're if you're in the game, you're not likely to be reporting as vigorously as you might otherwise. And that's true in politics and in sports. But what about journalists on Air Force One? And that's a question that a listener has posed. Do they pay when they fly on Air Force One?
Yes, they do, and they should.
Yes, they should.
Yeah, and they do.
But do they pay like coach fare or first class? What?
I've heard editors complaining about the cost, so I am almost sure that it's more than first class, more than coach, but I don't know for sure. It's a good question.
That's a good question. Yeah. But it would be fun to fly on Air Force One.
Absolutely.
No doubt about it.
And one of the essayists writes that Trump on the plane is like the maitre d' in Mar-a-Lago, offering Diet Cokes and everything else and opening them for you if you want them to.
Yeah, well, Trump's no fool, and he knows that most people like to be liked. And sometimes with a wink, he's saying in public, I have to say I can't stand you, but in private, you're okay. And some journalists are okay with that and others are not. But that's the nature of the beast right now. And Trump has opened an age that is going to be difficult to change.
Right.
How will it be moving forward?
Well, actually, one of the writers in the book, Frank Sesno, a CNN pioneer, who's now at George Washington University, wrote a fairly detailed essay about how he would change political coverage. And the key element is focus on the consequences. What is this presidential decision? How's it going to affect us? Rather than the tumult about it, which we journalists tend to focus on too much.
Have another segment with Jerry Seppos, the longtime dean of the Manship School. He spent 30 years in San Jose, California, one of the great newspapers in America, the Mercury News. James Carville says of the book, the personal stories of journalists after journalists being harassed by the Trump administration make this a shocking read, but their battle to remain objective and to fight for information is inspirational. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, another segment with Jerry Seppos. The book is from LSU Press, appropriately, covering politics in the age of Trump. And lots of plaudits, including Connie Chung, who was a college classmate at the University of Maryland of Jerry, saying covering any president of the U.S. has always been complicated, a symbiotic dance. In this book, prominent journalists unveil their inside stories of covering Trump and why even wizened reporters were shocked by this White House like no other. You must read it. Now, shocked seems to be the operative word. And the essays that are in the book are from those near and far. Mark Ballard, our Thursday guest on most Thursdays, is in there. And there are many others, including Charlie Cook, who is probably the preeminent analyst of American politics when it comes to congressional races in the country, and a pretty good forecaster when it comes to elections. But there are many others as well, including Mark Leibovich, who wrote, I think, one of the two or three best books ever about Washington politics, This Town. You go back a long way with him.
Yeah, we hired Mark in San Jose as a young reporter, and my heart was broken when he left to go to the Washington Post, and the Post's heart was broken when he left to go to the New York Times. He's had a very broad and distinguished career.
He's one remarkable reporter, yeah. And that book has held up well.
Yes.
I was reading through it not so long ago, and it captures Washington, and it was written before the Trump
right.
years. There was actually some good journalism going on before Trump, but the stories in your book covering politics in the age of Trump, even from seasoned reporters, they were stunned by the magnitude of what was going on.
Well, Mark Leibovich is a good example of that. He says that Trump just beseeched him, just begged him to do a New York Times Magazine profile. And when he did it, while Trump was pleasant about it, he said it was a terrible job. It was just a horrible story. And repeatedly told some of the authors in the book that they were just bad journalists. Didn't hold back at all, and that's no surprise, I guess. But it's an unusual way of treating the press, to say the very least.
And like a lot of bullies, he can dish it out, but when people criticize him, he doesn't handle it very well, does he?
No. However, I should point out that three essays in the book are about the failings of journalism, not of Trump. One of the Charlie Cook, who's, by the way, a native of Louisiana, as you know, Charlie Cook wrote his own headline for his installment, his essay, and the headline was The Downfall of Journalism. And he argues that journalistic credibility is based on a perception of absolute impartiality, and he thinks journalists violated that while covering Trump. And Tom Rosenstiel of the American Press Institute, probably the most serious scholar of American journalism, says that the greatest threat to journalism is that Trump will have goaded the press, as he said, into becoming the institution he accuses of being, a partisan opposition voice.
Mm-hmm.
So there are voices in here that say the press was the problem.
I think there was some overboard treatment, and there's a difference between being an editorial columnist or a radio talk host and a everyday reporter. And I concur totally, and I think it's accurate and fair to call the allegations of voter fraud costing Trump the election the big lie. But to call him a liar, I heard Michael Wolff last night. He says Trump believes it. So if he believes it, he's not a liar. He's telling a lie, but to call him a liar, that's probably over the edge or close to it.
well, probably 3 or 4 years ago, the New York Times used liar, the word liar, in the lead headline, and that led to a lot of discussion. The Washington Post still does not call him a liar. Interestingly, Mark Leibovich of the Times Magazine refers to him as a liar in my book.
Mike in Villa Del Rey, you're on with Jerry Seppas. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. To your caller, I have a question. I mean, to your guest, I have a question. Both Andrew Dice Clay and Howard Stern has stated that Trump stole their act to become president. What does your guest think of that?
The bombastic, over-the-top, outrageous persona. There is a lot of that in Trump, and he's also, by the way, a member of the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, the only U.S. president to ever been accorded that honor. There's a lot of pro wrestling in Donald Trump.
There is, and there's a lot of television, as you said, Jim, in Donald Trump. And I think the listener's quote is a pretty good one. I think he learned lessons from all sorts of people and just absorbed them brilliantly in a certain manner of speaking.
Now, there is, and this goes to a question from a listener about Twitter, and we can't mention Trump without Twitter. He's now been banned, but he used it effectively to change the subject when he didn't like it, and he did it on a regular basis, and at least one of your essayists comments on this phenomenon.
Yeah, Twitter is really seen as the basis for everything that he did. That's probably going a little too far. But it is interesting, now that he's been kicked off of Twitter, his visibility is indeed much less. So there is something to be said for the importance of Twitter in getting Trump where he got.
Well, appropriately, Jerry Seppas dedicates his book to Martin Johnson. He was a protege of yours, your successor as the dean, and died tragically. And just saying his name, I can feel the pain that you feel.
Yeah, the book was Martin's idea. He called me in November or December of 2019 and said, I think you could pull off this idea. What do you think of it? And I said, I loved it. And I started working on it then. The last time I actually saw Martin was in March of last year when actually on the very day that LSU said clear out the campus, we were going to be virtual. And ironically, he and I dropped off a first draft of the LSU Press that day. The week he died, ironically, in November of last year, was the very week that the final draft was due.
Well, it's an exceptional book, and the first from Jerry Seppas, who's had a long career in journalism. And the last part of it, Trump's worst habit. What's his worst habit? I think I know. What's his worst habit, Jerry?
Abusing journalists, I think, would be the bottom line.
All right. Bill Huey sent an email regarding your previous appearance on this show and says, what about LSU continuing to refrain from public statements about the elephant in the room across the campus, across the street from the J School, where Jerry still resides as dean emeritus? There is still much controversy.
Yeah, I think the biggest controversy right now is whether students should be required to be vaccinated this fall. And I believe that is not going to be the case. And I personally wish it were, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, there's lots of good journalism on the LSU campus. And some of the people who came through the journalism school when you were there are now big shots in Washington, and they are featured in this book.
They are. Quinn Forgey is at Politico, and Ginger Gibson, who graduated just before I got there, was at Reuters and now is at NBC News.
Major Garrett, who's been a guest on this show, and he's working at Fox. I asked him, when you run into Bill O'Reilly in the hall, does he speak to you? He says, no, I'm just a lowly reporter. He's Bill O'Reilly. Well, he spoke to a lot of other people and paid a woman $12 million for statements that he made to her, and she ultimately went public anyway. But
right.
But Major Garrett, he's a good one. Now at CBS News.
Correct, and he wrote a very thoughtful and deep essay also about what journalism really should be and hasn't yet achieved.
Well, it is a good book covering lots of ground with people near and far. You mentioned Ashley Parker, and a listener asked, what's the focus of her essay?
A lot of the essays are deeply personal, and I hope that they will give readers some insight into how journalists think. And Ashley's is really about the embarrassment she felt that very first day she was called out from the podium, but also repeated instances after. Very personal. You get a real look into her mind.
Covering Politics in the Age of Trump from Jerry Seppos, out and about from LSU Press. It's a good one, so we'll be calling on Jerry again soon. And up next is Jason Berry, and he'll reflect on another rogue who was both revered and reviled in Louisiana for decades, Edwin Washington Edwards, who died Monday. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your Talk Louisiana number is 877-217-5757. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org, and we turn the page with Jason Berry, talented and intrepid journalist based in the great city of New Orleans, and has written about New Orleans like few, if any, others. He knows the city, its politics, its culture, its music, everything about New Orleans, Jason Berry knows, and he goes back to Jesuit High School, where he graduated, also a graduate of Georgetown University. And for those who are familiar with his long career, he was the foremost journalist in the early years of exposing issues in the Catholic Church. And his books include Lead Us Not into Temptation, Catholic Priests, and the Sexual Abuse of Children. In 1992, almost 30 years, it was the first major book on this issue. But he's here today to talk primarily about the Cajun Prince, Edwin Washington Edwards, who died at 93 on Monday. And Leo Honeycutt has sent some information about services that I don't know if this has been widely reported, but here we go. Leo says that there will be a lying in state open to the public on Saturday at the Capitol Rotunda, and on Sunday a service at the old state capitol, but invitation only because there are only 200 seats available. So that's how Edwin Washington Edwards will go out. And Jason Berry has written about the former governor, as well as he has other former governors, including the Longs, Earl and Huey. But for those who have never read Last of the Red Hot Papas, it was a rollicking story from Jason, a novel that has some of Edwin in it, if you read the book. And it is a novel in which some say that Edwin comes across okay. He is a rogue in the book. He was a rogue in life. He got much done, but his controversy makes him a complex American figure, and certainly a Louisiana figure who was both loved and hated by the populace. Jason Berry, your thoughts about the long life and the legacy of Edwin Washington Edwards.
Well, Jim, thank you for having me on, and I think it is first appropriate to extend condolences to the family of the late governor, his wife and son, and his older children, and many grandchildren. So, you know, anytime someone dies, we want to be respectful of those who are grieving. I had ambivalent, to say the least, feelings about Edwards. I certainly recognize his enormous talent as a politician. I mean, very few public figures can summon the kind of rapier wit that he had. You know, all those zingers for which he is famous, unsafe with voters unless caught in bed with a dead woman or a live boy. You know, it was not illegal for me to take the money, even if it was illegal for him to give the money. You could go down that long list. But I think we have forgotten, really, the terrible damage he did to the environment. You know, in the 1970s, he opened the state to massive chemical waste dumping. The story of how Browning Ferris Industries got into Louisiana is really a political story of Edwin Edwards' naked cynicism toward the environment. And although there's been a good deal of journalism and reporting on that over the years, it never really stuck. And that was something that always, I don't want to say it amazed me, but it disappointed me. You know, in 1983, for example, when he ran, after sitting out for 4 years, he ran the third time against Dave Treen. And Treen, of course, being the first Republican governor, you know, was something of a reformer. And he ran these TV spots saying, these are the toxic waste pits that Edwin Edwards left that I'm now cleaning. I thought those were pretty potent messages. And yet Edwards clobbered him. You know, I think he won by 62-63%. And it is a sign, I think, of how not only this state, but many states sort of crave a character they like and are willing to look beyond the terrible things he's done. You know, I think that's how Donald Trump got elected. Mm-hmm. You know, Trump had a great deal of baggage, especially when he was running for reelection, and yet, you know, he came within whatever it was, 8 or 10 million votes. So demagoguery, you know, is an art form, and it's a dark art form, but it's the ability to make people think that something false is true. And I think Edwards was a master at that.
When we look at the skyline in New Orleans where you are perched, certainly the Superdome was completed under Edwards' watch. He had to coax the legislature into ponying up the last several million dollars. The Smoothie King Center was built, the Convention Center. And by the way, those last two were built at about the same price as the LSU Rec Center, which is certainly not the equal of those edifices. So he did a lot of things that were good, but he did, for those who believe that he was a populist, he was, yes, he was in some ways, but he also, unlike Huey Long, he was more like Russell Long. He got in bed with the oil and gas industry, and you're right, he allowed the expansion of those plants, and they provided jobs, but they provided a lot of bad stuff, too.
Well, that's true. You know, when you think about the trade-off this state has made over the years, I mean, we are still pretty much dead last on the crucial indices of education, of poverty, of health care. I mean, even, you know, with the Medicare expansion under Governor John Bel Edwards, this state, you know, we're part of the lost South, I think it's fair to say. You know, I came across a quote the other day. This is what he said in 1983 when he was running against Treen. He said, "You that are elderly and have seen your funds cut, you that are crippled, poor, or disabled, take heart. Take heart, for the great healer shall returneth, and he shall make you well." You know, he raised almost $15 million that year running for governor. That was more than any other governor had ever spent in American political history. Now, later budgets have skyrocketed, and Louisiana today doesn't cost as much for a guy to get elected, or a person to get elected governor, as say New York or California, places like that. But I think the contrast between that almost biblical line, the great healer shall come and he shall make you well, and what he actually did is a striking example of the kind of double standard of his populism. Yes, he was very popular. He was a magician in some ways on the hustings. I'll never forget, I interviewed him at the Crowley Rice Festival in 1991. He was running against Duke this time. And I was standing on the street with Philip Gould, the photographer from Lafayette. And Edwards, there was a motorcade. Edwards came first, and he was sitting inside an SUV, and he was waving to people. But it was kind of noteworthy that this guy running for governor was not, you know, sitting up in a flatbed truck or something like that. And then a few minutes later, Duke comes around the turn, And he is sitting up, I mean, fully exposed, waving to people, you know, waving his arms up. And rumors were circulating that there had been death threats against Edwards. So we head out after that to a private reception. And, you know, they let the press go to these things. It was at a, I don't know, some guy's lake house outside Crowley. And all of his old friends are there. Judge Reggie and his wife were there, and various people from John Brough's camp and so forth. And Edwin Edwards was eating a plate of red beans. And so I sidled up to him and I said, "Governor, I wonder if I could just ask you a question." And he said, "Yeah, what you got?" And I said, "What will it take for you to win?" And he didn't bat an eye. He said, "To stay alive."
Yeah. that was the Duke race, yeah. And Louisiana's law then, and I think now, I don't think it's been changed, is that if there's a runoff, as there was between Duke and Edwards, and we're talking about the dates between October 19th and November 16th, if Edwards had been assassinated, Duke would have been the governor.
Well, that's interesting. I was not aware of that at that time, and I am edified by your vast knowledge of Louisiana politics, Jim, which far outstrips my own. But, you know, we all know what a fabled poker player he was, and, you know, he was an inveterate gambler. But the more you look back on a comment like that, that's a gambler's remark. I'm going to win as long as somebody doesn't get me. And I was sort of dumbstruck by the comment. Naturally, I quoted it in the piece I did for the Washington Post. But I asked him, I said, "Well, you know, you're getting a lot of death threats." And he kind of looked at me, you know, with that eye, and he shrugged, and he just, you know, put his spoon in the plate. And that was kind of the end of the interview. The message was, come on, man, you're really going to ask me that question and expect me to answer? He was unlike any politician I've ever met. But I don't say that with a rising sense of admiration. I don't know. He was what he was, and there was no one like him. But I don't view him in any sense as a great political figure.
We're going to pick up from there. Edwin Washington Edwards, he was a giant, but was he a great political figure? Jason Berry will take some calls, and we'll visit with him about the passing of Edwin Washington Edwards, 93 years old. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Jason Berry is with us, and most recently his book was about his city of New Orleans, City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. He's here talking about Edwin Edwards, who died at 93 on Monday, and he mentioned that appearance in 1983 when Edwin Edwards all but acted and spoke like the Messiah, and he beat David Treen by about 25 points in that race. And as Jason noted, he invested $15 million in his campaign, which would be $41 million today in today's dollars. But Edwin Edwards, who knew the Bible and once was a preacher, was a Catholic, then was not, then was a Catholic again. In the latter part of his life, he acknowledged that he was a non-believer, and that happened in a very public place 10 years ago on this program, right after he got out of jail. Here's Edwin Edwards.
Are you a spiritual man?
Not in the sense that people think of it. I'm not the kind of person, and I say this, and I know it's gonna pick some ears. I'm not the kind of person who think there's an entity out there that is interested in whether or not the next roll of the dice is going to come up good, or whether or not my team is going to win a football game, or whether the stock market is going to go up or down. I don't think that there's an entity that micromanages people's lives. Now, if you have faith, that's fine. But I don't think that one should rely upon some magical power to solve their problems. Let me tell you something. If prayer healed people, 265 popes that have died in the history of our world would not have died, because every time one got sick, thousands of people were praying for him. And look, I'm sorry. I wish that they had not died, but they did die. And it didn't matter how many people were praying for them not to die. Faith is a wonderful thing, but it has to be based on reason. You can have all the faith you want, but you jump off of a building, you're going to die. Nothing's going to stop you in midair.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall the last time you prayed?
Yes, this morning.
Okay.
I prayed that you wouldn't give me a hard time, and my prayers are not being answered.
That's Edwin Washington Edwards. Jason Berry, he didn't talk much about not believing when he was running for office, but at the end, he was defiant and saying that basically, I asked him where he's going. He says, I'm going right in the ground. That's where I'm going.
Well, you know, I had never heard that interview before. I was aware of the fact that he gave it. And, you know, according to the news coverage, he said that he was no longer a believer. But the thing that struck me just now, Jim, listening to his words, is that they're almost nonsensical. If you're talking about whether or not you believe in a supreme being, that's one thing. But to say that prayers to change the stock market or the fact that 265 popes died because prayers were not answered, again, it's not tied down by reason. No one has ever assumed that people could pray to God to halt the death of an elderly pope or an elderly anybody. It's something else if you're praying for the life of a child with a severe illness, and people who believe in a personal God do so. But I don't know. I thought it was a rather muddled response. And if he's explaining why he is not a believer, and certainly, you know, he's well within his rights to believe or not believe, but I wish he had given a more coherent answer.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Jason Berry. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jim. One of my favorite quotes from him was asked how he was doing, and he said, well, you know, you're only as young as the woman you feel.
Only
what
as
a good
old.
Play on words.
Only as old.
I'm sorry. Only as old as the woman you feel.
That was shortly before he married his third wife, Trina, and each wife got younger than the previous one. His first wife was approximately the same age as he, and he was born in 1927. Second wife was born in 1964, and third wife in 1978. So Edwin Washington Edwards died with a woman 51 years and 12 days his junior at his side, and God bless him. He would have wanted to go out that way, and that he did, Jason.
Well, he did. And, you know, the fact that he has a little boy, I think his son is 8 years old, and he was 93, is, you know, quite a testament to his longevity. Whether he was a believer or not, he was certainly blessed with good genes.
In 2013, he was interviewed by Larry King at the LSU Union, and Larry passed earlier this year, January 23rd. But he had lived in Louisiana for a bit after his fall from grace in Miami, and he knew Edwin Edwards because Larry was the track announcer at Louisiana Downs, and Edwin, of course, spent a lot of quality time at that facility. But he called me, and we actually did an interview, but off the air he says, you know, I don't want to talk about stuff everybody talk about, his politics and his four terms. That's old news. He says, what's new? I said, well, he's just had a baby boy. And Larry's comment was, the girl must have wanted it really bad. I'll give Larry credit. He got something from Edwin Edwards I never did. At that interview, for which Larry was paid $60,000, by the way, for 1 hour, he asked him, he said, did you do this or was it done artificially? And Edward said, it was baby gravy. And Larry said, you mean you can't perform anymore? And Edwin said, no, I can't. And what a revelation from Edwin Washington Edwards to acknowledge that he could no longer perform as we know he once did.
Who paid Larry King $60,000?
LSU paid him. They paid Edwin Edwards $6,000, and they paid Leo Honeycutt nothing, but those were the three people on stage. Leo, zero, Edwin, $6,000, and Larry, $60,000.
Wow.
$60,000 for 1 hour, and you know what? He didn't even stay overnight. He was back on a plane to Los Angeles. That's not bad.
No, that's not bad. I guess it's a sign of how desperate LSU is for that kind of coverage, but I'm rather struck by all that money.
Yeah, that's big money for even Larry King. But Jim Richardson, the same year at the business school, he arranged a meeting of former governors and the current governor, Bobby Jindal, who declined to be there, as I recall. But all the others showed up, all the living governors. And I was honored to have been the moderator that day. And it was Kathleen Blanco, Buddy Romer, Mike Foster, and Edwin Edwards. And you know what? They're all gone 8 years later. And every one of them, in their own way, was still in fine form in 2013. And that's a sobering thought for all of us, Jason, is that you and I know we're closer to the end than the beginning.
I try not to think about that, Jim. I just wake up every morning and I do say my prayers. Thank you for the life I have. Thank you for the people I love. You know, so far it's worked.
So far it's worked. But Edwin was sent away at 75 years old, a 10-year sentence, and that was deemed a life sentence. It was designed to be a life sentence. And here's a man who went to jail and served his time, didn't complain, and, as he said, didn't pray. He didn't get down on his hands and knees and say, "Lord, get me out of this joint." He took it about as well as a person could.
You know, the amazing thing about his prison years is that he was campaigning up until the day he went in. He was giving interviews right and left. He was on the radio. I mean, he was talking to reporters, I think, almost literally as he, you know, walked into the prison. And I know from someone who was in the facility at the same time that when a new inmate would arrive, he would get a little plastic bag with a toothpaste and toothbrush. And Edwards, he was campaigning inside the prison. He was setting himself up as sort of this benevolent figure. He was giving out stuff. Now, I'm sure they had card games. Well, I shouldn't say. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it was illegal for them to play cards inside or not. But he sent out newsletters, and I got one. I sent him a copy of the novel, Last of the Red Hot Papas, and I autographed it to him. You know, I didn't know him well, but I, you know, met him and interviewed him. And I got the strangest note back. It was one of these form letters that he sent out to people every so often. You know, his thoughts on what was going on in the world, not too much on prison life, at least the one I got. And he said, "Thanks for the book. Interesting!" Exclamation point.
Interesting. I bet he read it. I bet he read it.
He probably did. I think he did. It's not a very flattering portrait of the fictional governor, Rex LaSalle, who dies on page 2 in the mansion, poisoned. And it's a story of a cover-up. The first lady has to bury him with dignity and then find out who did it and why. But it is... It was also a way for me to come to terms with the strange relationship of comedy and tragedy in Louisiana politics. You know, so many of these war horses who become governor, you know, the Longs, Edwards, Mike Foster, you know, these are people who, you know, have a sort of commanding sense of themselves.
Thank you, Jason Berry. You've got a roll. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services.